From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Irma swamps Florida and the Caribbean, DACA talk, Hillary Clinton speaks, Steve Bannon speaks, Floridians struggle to get back on their feet after Irma. Here's Florida resident Danny Gonzalez.
I don't want to say the word hell, but it's been like hell. It's been a struggle for everybody here, but you know what? We're going to make it. We're helping each other. But hopefully we get electrical here quick because people are running out of gas and generators.
New York, Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer spoke on the Senate floor yesterday about a deal on DACA he said had been made with President Trump.
We all agreed on a framework. Pass DACA protections and additional border security measures, excluding the wall.
And Hillary Clinton out with a book about what went wrong in her failed bid for president.
What if I hadn't made the dumb mistake about emails, and it was a dumb mistake, but it was an even dumber scandal? What if the Russians hadn't been literally encouraged by Donald Trump to do even more to disrupt the election?
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Alan Gomez, Jennifer Jacobs, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us online, on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Did you live through Irma? What now and what next with DACA? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Miami is Alan Gomez, Miami-based correspondent for USA Today. He's been all over Florida this week, the Keys and all, covering Irma. Alan Gomez, especially in this week, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
With us from Washington is Jennifer Jacobs, White House reporter for Bloomberg News. Jennifer, good to have you here.
Hi, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Alan, and Jennifer.
Alan, may we come first to you, and again, a deep thanks for you joining us. I know you've been going like wild, and it's been very rough in Florida this week. What's your sense? We all know what was feared. We saw on the weather maps what happened, and many of our listeners will have been through it, but you went right through it. What, compared to what was most feared, what do we see now in Florida? What happened with Irma?
Compared to the storm track that we saw, what was it, last Thursday or so?
Yeah.
We dodged a bullet. I mean, there was a time when the eye was supposed to go right over downtown Miami, over that incredibly populated region as a Cat 4, as a Cat 5. It went down over Cuba, weakened a little bit, didn't regain as much as we worried that it would. And so overall, I think people realized that this could have been far, far worse. But it was still a Cat 4 storm when it hit in the Florida Keys. It was still a Cat 3 when it hit on the Florida mainland. And there are, you know, we're still millions of people here without power. It's, people here are watching very carefully to see how FEMA and the federal government responds to this, because it's been slow, it's been difficult, and we dodged the big bullet, but yeah, now we're at that point where it's sort of like, okay, when's everything getting here?
Of course, the Caribbean did not dodge that bullet, including the U.S. Virgin Islands. I've got a little tape here. A resident of St. Thomas, Yvonne Deneau, said conditions there are very bad after Irma.
They need help. They definitely need help. And I know they're saying a lot about, they're saying that St. Thomas is U.S. It is, but it doesn't feel like it. And it feels like a third world country.
Certainly feels like an island and looks like an island that has just been torn up. And it's not, of course, only St. Thomas. Some real heavy damage there in the Caribbean. We'll look more at that on Monday right here on Point. The president in Florida again this week, talking about what that state has seen.
We love the people of Florida, and they went through something that I guess the likes of which we could really say nobody's ever seen before. They've never seen a category like this come in, because it came in really at a 5. All you have to do is look at what happened in the Keys. But we love these people, and we're going to be back, and we're going to help.
Alan Gomez, is it back to business as usual after Irma, or something else in Florida? What's the talk there now?
No, absolutely not. This is, you know, I think people down here understand, first off, that the federal government has been a little busy with Hurricane Harvey. That was an incredibly difficult storm to respond to and required a lot of assets, a lot of personnel. And then to have to come down here and basically cover the entire state of Florida and respond to it. So there's an understanding of the size and the scope and the magnitude of this. But at the same time, it's, you know, there's down in Southwest Florida where this made landfall. In Fort Myers, for example, FEMA has not set up a disaster recovery center as of yesterday, as of last check. You know, those the kind of places where they distribute water and ice and things like that. Further south in Collier County, where it made landfall, there's places like Everglades City, cities like Immokalee that are in the Everglades, and there's a lot of low-income workers there. And my colleagues at the Naples Daily News have been through there, and they say they haven't seen a FEMA person throughout that area. Down in the Keys, I can tell you there's a lot of anger because it's been taking a really long time for people to get back to their homes while the federal government has been kind of throwing out this message that the Keys are devastated and wiped out. And yes, there was incredible damage. To last count, I think, is 26 people have died from this storm in Florida. And so we know it's tough. But at the same time, you know, I'm here in Miami-Dade County, and there's still no distribution centers for people for water, for ice. And when you talk about Florida at this time of year with no power, and there's still at least a million people from Florida Power and Light customers that don't have power, that makes it really difficult, and it's very dangerous, as we saw with the nursing home where 8 people died after they lost power after the storm. So these are very still dangerous conditions to be down here without that without that kind of assistance.
People are just really upset. I mean, the relatives of those who died in that nursing home, you know, this was Vendetta Craig. Her mother, Edna Jefferson, was one of those rescued, but she was still furious after the days that those elders spent in brutal heat. A reporter for CBS asked the daughter, remember her name is Vendetta, what she wanted to say to the facility's owner.
We coming for you. We coming for you. This is unacceptable. You messed with my mom. He messed with my mom. I'm not taking it.
Power's still out for many. This is not a comfortable situation, to say the very, very least. Southwest Florida and more. And with all the talk of climate change and what's coming, you wonder about the future of Florida. Southwest Florida, you mentioned, Alan. Let's go there. Sarah is calling from St. Petersburg, Florida. Sarah, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. So my husband and I just got married a few months ago.
Yeah.
And we've lived in St. Petersburg, or the area, our entire lives. Our family's all from here. We were considering buying a house, but after Irma, we're definitely not investing in property here.
Why?
Climate change is something you really can't ignore now. I mean, it's pretty obvious, you know, that the warmer waters, I think at least, that climate change is playing a huge role in this. And, you know, it's happening a lot quicker, I think, than we anticipated. And I don't really think you can ignore that. And, you know, if I'm building for the long-term future, we're only 24. We don't want to invest in something and then have to move in 10 years because the sea level rise or because it's destroyed. I mean, we didn't even know if our house was going to be standing when the original storm track was, like, released.
Yeah. That's a lot of uncertainty to deal with. Of course, Floridians have also always been in kind of a marginal land, but they've built lives there and homes there and lots of pleasure taken from Florida. Jennifer Jacobs in Washington, as the White House and Congress looked down at Florida, we saw after Hurricane Harvey, they started writing the big checks right away, and Texas talking about 100-plus billion. What about Florida and what it's going to take to get it back on its feet? Is Washington ready to deliver again, and is it back to business as usual? Is that the idea?
I do think there's commitment in the White House to make sure that happens. That the Trump administration was trying to signal that yesterday with President Trump and Vice President Pence's trip down there. We were asking questions on Air Force One about, you know, when are you going to go to the Virgin Islands? And you know, there's a report you're going to Puerto Rico. At first, his press staff said, listen, we're only focused on Florida today. Later, President Trump kind of overrode that and did confirm that he intends to go to the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico on the same day next week. But they are willing to do whatever it takes. They've said that so many times to make sure that the funding is there for Florida.
Eric in Land O'Lakes, Florida, also down that way, southwest, north of Tampa. Eric, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I got to tell you, we ended up evacuating from the Tampa Bay area on Wednesday before last. We left at midnight. We headed up to stay with family in Loganville, Georgia, which is a suburb of Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And normally that would take us about 8 hours. It took us about 12 on Interstate 75. It was like something out of a post-apocalyptic movie. People were, of course, the highway traffic was bad, but once it got to about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, people were pulling over to sleep along the side of the highway. And we came back to Tampa a couple nights ago. And it took us just as long. We took Country Highway 19 instead. And I actually saw, I think, more damage in Georgia, South Georgia, than I did in Florida. But it was just crazy.
Post-apocalyptic. Eric, I appreciate your call. Jack Beatty, what have you been thinking through this week as we've all watched, right on the heels of Harvey, the terrible fear of what was coming with Irma, and then the reality in the Caribbean and in Florida? You hear Floridians calling us today saying, you know, post-apocalyptic, not going to buy that house. And yet people have lives rooted here.
They have lives and livelihoods, and both of them have been disrupted. Yeah, I've been struck by President Trump's rhetoric. You quoted some where he said, this is a terrible, unprecedented storm. Yet, I believe on Air Force One, asked about global warming, the connection with global warming, he said, we've had bigger storms than this. According to MIT's Kerry Emanuel, we haven't. He's wrong factually. Harvey, more rainfall than any other hurricane in a recorded history. Irma, it maintained Category 5 wind speed longer than any other hurricane for which there's data. So we haven't had bigger storms than this.
But you've had bigger storms hitting Florida, worse damage ultimately. Maybe not as widespread, but I mean, look at Andrew, all those stretches of homes just totally destroyed. Florida didn't have that. I mean, in some narrow way, he's right, but the bigger picture, maybe not.
Maybe not. And, you know, look at Andrew. I was struck reading today that after Andrew and how the trailer homes were decimated there and people lost lives and just horrible homestead and so on, that there were new safety measures put in place, new anchors for these things and other adaptations that seem to have really made a difference. And one wonders what will be the resilience upshot of this crisis. Will there be something like that for, I don't know, people like our callers in St. Petersburg, some adaptation that'll help them?
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Irma, North Korea launches again a test missile flight. Trump and DACA, Hillary speaks, Bannon speaks. Outrage over Equifax and the debacle there with private information put out all over the place in the many, many, many millions. The Democrats and single-payer Medicare for all, as Bernie Sanders says this week. Alan Gomez is with us from USA Today, joins us today from Miami, Florida. Jennifer Jacobs is here, White House reporter for Bloomberg News. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. What are you thinking? The bottom line on Irma, on a deal, on DACA, if indeed it's been done? Are you with Bernie Sanders for single payer on health care with the Republicans and let states do it? And how close can North Korea's missile tests come before something? Donald Trump sat down with Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, the Senate Minority Leader. Schumer was on the Senate floor yesterday, said the president did agree on a plan to enshrine protections for young immigrants during a dinner on Wednesday night.
There's still much to be done. We have to put meat on the bones of the agreement. Details will matter, but it was a very, very positive step for the president to commit to DACA protections without insisting on the inclusion of or even a debate about the border wall.
And ardent Trump supporters went crazy. Here was Laura Ingraham describing the reported DACA deal as a Freddy Krueger deal. Here she was.
And now, like the Freddy Krueger of all legislative policies, the same policy is back. Except I think a lot of people didn't think it would be happening under the presidency of Donald J. Trump.
Okay. And Steve King, Iowa Republican, one of the president's core supporters, said those supporters are loyal, but they don't want to compromise at all on immigration. Would crack his base, says King.
They came on board because build a wall, enforce the border, enforce immigration law, no amnesty ever. And if they see amnesty coming out of the White House, then that's the one thing that will crack his base.
The president, vague on exactly what's happened here, he talked with reporters yesterday before walking to Marine One, said he's fairly close to a deal with congressional leaders on DACA.
We're working on a plan. We'll see how it works out. But we're going to get massive border security as part of that. And I think something can happen. We'll see what happens.
Something will happen.
We'll see what happens. That is a very frequent refrain of the president lately. Jennifer Jacobs, what do we know about what has happened here?
Well, we are confused at first about some of the contours of the deal, but it does sound like after several interviews with the president yesterday, as he was traveling to and from Florida, that what they agreed upon was they agreed to reach a deal that includes some sort of protections for those dreamers, but not to include wall funding for the wall and not have a debate over the wall, but do include some extreme security measures, as the president said. And as you pointed out, some of his most loyal backers think he's making a mistake. They think that the only leverage that Trump has right now to get that border wall funded is to include it with any sort of a DACA bill. And so you had prominent conservatives just roasting the president yesterday. Ann Coulter said, listen, I'm still on the Trump train, but he's off. And other people saying, you know, he said he wants to renovate parts of the existing fence, and that's not what he said on the campaign trail. He said, build that wall. That people weren't going around chanting, renovate parts of the existing fence. Mm. They were saying, build that wall. So you had another GOP strategist who tweeted something about, you know, we'll find out if anyone cares about a shooting on Fifth Avenue. Because remember, Trump in Iowa back a couple summers ago was saying, you know, his supporters are so fervent, he could just about shoot, a gun on Fifth Avenue and no one would care. But it does sound like his most fervent supporters really do care about this.
Is it the wall funding that the most fervent supporters are so upset about? Or is it the dreamers themselves, the 800,000 or so, that they want them out? They want them gone.
Right. Trump has said on the campaign trail, and now he does want to permanently safeguard these people. He keeps trying to clarify that it's not amnesty. However, you know, the deputy White House spokeswoman, Lindsay Walters, told us on Air Force One yesterday that these immigrants, what they're looking at is some sort of a responsible path forward, is what she said. And she said that could include legal citizenship over a period of time. Lindsay Walters said there will be no amnesty. Trump repeated that to us multiple times throughout the day, that amnesty is a red hot, you know, trigger word for, you know, his most fervent supporters. They insisted it's not amnesty, but it's a matter of interpretation there. And you're exactly right. Those supporters do want the wall. It's one of their core tenets. It's one of the reasons they elect him. But they also are very worried about amnesty for people who came to the country illegally.
Boy, there's a lot of dancing here. Rush Limbaugh yesterday saying the media is conveying this or portraying this as a deal, but it's not. Here was Limbaugh.
They want you to think Trump has sold you out and thrown you under the bus. They want you to think that Trump has given away his mandate in exchange for doing deals.
Well, I don't know. Here was Trump again walking to Marine One yesterday saying he's still committed to the southern border wall, but it was talking about different samples, different ways. It'll come later. Here was Trump.
The wall will come later. We're right now renovating large sections of wall, massive sections, making it brand new. We're doing a lot of renovation. We're building four different samples of the wall to see which one we're going to choose. And the wall is going to be built. It'll be funded a little bit later.
Alan Gomez, you've covered immigration so much. I know you've been focused on the Irma this week and its aftermath, but I'm sure this makes your screen. What do you see playing out here? And what's the dance of negotiation that's going on, Alan?
I mean, first off, imagine following the news on the DACA development this week in short bursts of news as you get cell phone service here and there. It's at one point there's a deal. I'm like, what am I missing? The next moment, no, it's off. But what I look at when I see what Trump has been saying the last couple of days is just the latest in a very long history of his of going all over the place on this program. Several years ago, before he was running for president, he said that he met with some dreamers and they won him over. They were wonderful and fantastic. On the campaign trail, he vowed to end the program and he said that they had to go. He wins election. He says, no, I'm going to treat them with a great heart. But then the one concrete action he's taken, which was, wow, I guess just the beginning of last week, which seems quite a bit longer than that.
Yeah.
He announced that he was phasing out the DACA program to protect them within the next 6 months. And then immediately kind of came back to this idea. He might do something now. He's kind of doing this back and forth. And I say all that to make the point that if you're in Congress right now, I think working with the president on this issue is much like how it was when he was trying to get Obamacare repealed, where he's kind of laying some general guidelines and a broad stroke. But really, at this point, the House and the Senate really need to start getting together to figure out what they're going to do. We have several proposals in the House that has some Republican support for some versions of the DREAM Act. Same thing going on over in the Senate. And I think it's going to come down to them to really start putting the meat on those bones and finally sending something up to him.
But is he burning bridges with that base? Maybe they're calling. Roland in Nashville. Thanks for calling, Roland. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom. I've been with Trump from the beginning. I consider myself, I guess, an ardent Trump supporter, and I thought it was a welcome surprise to see him making a deal with Chuck and Nancy, and I feel like it's a good opportunity for both sides to give a little bit, and if Trump's willing to give on the DACA, the Dems should be willing to give on the wall, and maybe that'll be a new path forward for some bipartisanship.
But let me ask you, Roland, because Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi both said that the deal was not an agreement on the wall. If that's the case, are you? Is it a problem for you as a Trump supporter?
It sort of is, because it seems like we're willing to work with them and they're unwilling to work with us. I feel like the wall would help legal immigration move forward because it would prevent what's coming up the works for people is more illegal people coming in.
People looking for clarity there. Jack Beatty, that dream of a wall that would just make things black and white and end illegal immigration. And you can hear, you know, Roland's ready to do a deal, but he still wants that wall. What do you see emerging here, Jack?
Well, Roland is cross-pressured. I mean, he wants the wall, and he wants the Dreamers to get some relief. And that is, in fact, what Trump voters want. According to the polling, 67% of them want a wall, and 68% of them want the Dreamers to be taken care of. So this reaction from Rush Limbaugh and the others, it may be the elite reaction, but the base, if at least judged by last year's polling, seems to be about where Roland is, regretting not having the wall, perhaps. But I can imagine the president, talking about all the security measures they're going to take. And, of course, security experts say there are a lot better things than walls you can do down there. This gets at a reality of American politics, perhaps the dominant defining reality today, that partisanship is everything, not issues. If your party leader changes his position, you do too. As one headline said, Trump says jump, his supporters ask how high.
Jennifer, do you see funding for a wall out there somewhere? We heard the president saying later, later, later. But is it out there somewhere, anywhere, or not?
Well, Trump has not explained that to us. We're 8 months into his presidency, and he has not explained how he would get the money. But he did make it pretty clear yesterday that the money will have to come later, that he just wants to get this DACA deal done. And you've got a president who really would like to make things happen. This is the second such deal he's made with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi in as many weeks. You remember they had the agreement to delay the potential default on the nation's debt and the fight over the government budget until December. Trump is willing to work with people so that he can accomplish something. And another key thing is that you had several Republicans in Congress, despite, you know, the chatter from his conservative base, especially in the Senate, you had Republicans saying, yeah, they think they could support some kind of a package with DACA protections and border security that doesn't include the wall right now. You had John Thune, John Cornyn saying that they do want the wall, but for now it would be okay to just work on getting DACA through. So what Trump has his eye on right now, he keeps promising the wall funding. Who knows where that money would come from, but he just wants a deal.
Feeling the heat from the talking heads on the base front this week. No question about that. Healthcare, interesting this week. The Republicans with a last-ditch effort to repeal and replace Graham Cassidy and Bernie Sanders in the spotlight with a lot of Democratic senators this week and more support in the House talking about Medicare for All, a single-payer healthcare system. Here was the Vermont Independent on Wednesday.
All of us stand before you and proudly proclaim our belief that health care in America must be a right, not a privilege.
Lindsey Graham not going with Bernie Sanders' single payer there Wednesday. He said, look, you got three options here.
Prop up Obamacare, Bernie Care, or our bill. That's where you're at. Count me out for propping up Obamacare. Hell no to Bernie Care. Count me in for an idea that gives a patient a voice they would never have under single-payer health care. Count me in for people in my state making decisions about health care versus some bureaucrat in Washington.
Lindsey Graham, his plan would what, Jennifer? Turn more power back to the states? It would end the mandate and more kind of cut the legs out from under Obamacare. Is it repeal and replace?
That's a really good question. You know, what we're hearing from President Trump is that there's just no interest in this. But then you've got his conservative base again saying, look, he's been a changed president lately. He thanked the media yesterday. He's had dinner with the Democratic leadership. He's tweeting support for DACA. They said, you know, what about, you know, the next thing we know, he's going to be signing a bill for single payer, too. So everyone is worried about what he's going to rush towards next.
Jack, you're following this healthcare debate. The Democrats have come out now, a bunch of very prominent Democrats, including any number who are talked about with 2020 in mind, Elizabeth Warren and right on down, Kamala Harris and more. What do you think of the big push for single payer this week?
Well, you really have to scratch your head about the politics here. At the height of domestic liberalism in the 1960s, 1964, 77% of Americans said they trusted the government, quote, to do the right thing, quote, just about always. 77%. Mm-hmm. The latest polling, it's about 19% of Americans. There are 155 million Americans who are covered by insurance on their job. You've got to persuade them that to trust government to do it better than their private plan. Good luck with that. Bernie Sanders, it's as if all the history since the 1960s, the Vietnam War, Watergate, the disappointment of presidency after, as if none of that credibility issue with government has happened, and we can all just believe that government is terrific and it'll do it. That's not where the American people are, and to bring around those 155 million Americans, that's a task of persuasion for decades.
But there is other history here too, Jack. A lot of people struggling with their health care, and Americans watching the cost of things go up and up and up, drugs and all the rest. Irene in Tennessee, Franklin, Tennessee. Thanks for calling, Irene. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I'm a physician in a pediatric subspecialty, and, you know, we have been struggling under this system that's really in a state of early collapse. I've been studying the costs of health care, and the system is easily costing 92 to 94% of the healthcare dollar going to bureaucracy. It's not hard to come up with these figures, yet those figures have eluded the government and those in power who are actually looking at the numbers.
So would single-payer fix it? Would Graham Cassidy fix it? What, no. Irene?
No, single-payer could maybe cut by 10%, but it's such a complex house of cards that's all been well-meaning regulations and business involvement, that we would really have to have a focus on an actual commission on reducing the bureaucratic burdens of healthcare. Because really, healthcare costs have not gone up a dime in 30 years. As a physician, we're being paid less than rates in the 1970s. It's the costs of administering this ridiculous system. And so, you know, the single payer would just eliminate the insurance contribution to that cost, but not really get at the source of the problems, which have become so tangled in bureaucracy.
Boy, people looking for a way to cut through that. Irene, I appreciate your call. We're up against the clock here. Alan Gomez, I'm sure it's the last thing on Floridians' mind this week, but people ready for a big change on healthcare, or just like steady as she goes, Obamacare plus my private thing and let's go?
I think this week everybody's been focused a little bit elsewhere. You know, we're going to have a lot of discussions here about the state of nursing homes and what and how private insurers are handling those things right there, given what happened at the nursing home in Hollywood, Florida.
Not covered in glory there.
Yeah, so I think that's, sorry, but I think that's the focus right down here.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, the 16th anniversary of 9/11. New Yorker Mike Eddy said he goes to the World Trade Center every year with an American flag with the names of all the 9/11 dead on it.
Today just means everything. You know, you got to honor these people. They lost their lives in the biggest attack we had on our soil.
An underground blast fire this morning in the London subway. The BBC spoke with a man who was there with a fireball over his head.
This fireball above my head has come, singed all my hair. I've got sort of burn marks to the top of my head. And everyone just ran off the train.
And NASA received the final signal from the Cassini spacecraft this morning at 7:55 Eastern Time after it plunged to its planned destruction over Saturn.
Call loss of signal at 115546. For the S-band, so that would be the end of the spacecraft.
A long, long journey to the Saturn within its rings, its moons, and more by Cassini right there. We're looking at a week in the news. Irma, North Korea with its latest missile launch over Japan. Sirens going off there again. Hillary Clinton speaking this week. Steve Bannon on 60 Minutes. Equifax, the outrage over personal data. Deeply compromised there for many. You can join us this hour. What are you hearing from Hillary Clinton on her tour? What do you expect from Steve Bannon's war on the GOP establishment he says he's committed to? Who's got our back on the Equifax debacle? Does anybody? Are you following the plight of the Rohingya in Burma and across their western border there? And what are you thinking on Steve Mnuchin's call for a government honeymoon plane? The White House saying ESPN's Jemele Hill should be fired? Chelsea Manning in Harvard? Trump calling Jeff Sessions an idiot? The end of Cassini up on Saturn. Jennifer Jacobs is here, White House reporter for Bloomberg News. Alan Gomez is with us from Miami, where he's been covering Irma all week there. Jack Beatty's here. Hillary Clinton out with her book, What Happened, a big book on the campaign and how it all went wrong. She told Jane Pauley, host of CBS Sunday Morning, that her tone had not matched the mood of the country. Here's Hillary Clinton.
It was a mistake. Because a lot of people didn't want to hear my plans. They wanted me to share their anger. And I should have done a better job of demonstrating, I get it,
she said. Of course, there were people and circumstances to blame. She's done that as well. And she had words last night on MSNBC's Rachel Maddow show about the sitting president. She said she hopes more mature members of the White House staff can restrain the president from doing serious harm to the United States.
I think this president and some of the people around him pose a clear and present danger to our country.
Jack Beatty, what about Hillary Clinton and her book tour this week? It's got prickles in lots of directions, but also some self-reflection.
Yes, a complicated book, apparently. I haven't read it, but I do want Tom to just focus on one quote from that book. She says, political journalists can't bear to face their own role in helping elect Trump, from providing him free airtime to giving my emails three times more coverage than all the issues affecting people's lives combined. She's in fact right about that, according to the data. And according to a big study just that came out last month from the Shorenstein Center at the Kennedy School, the dominant note of the coverage in the campaign was negative, negative, negative from the press toward both candidates. They quote one scholar that the motto of the media today should be with malice toward all. And in fact, Hillary's, over the whole campaign, Hillary received more negative press, 62%, than Trump at 56%. Meanwhile, the issues, they got 10% of media attention. The horse race, nearly half. And we, the point that the Harvard study makes is that the bias toward the negative in the media is so bad that in that campaign it blurred the distinction between what they call an earnest politician, that is someone who more or less is serious, like Hillary Clinton, and what they call a charlatan, Mr.
Trump. So what are you saying? saying, Jack, forget the Russians, forget James Comey's last-minute moves, you know, forget all that, and media, know thyself?
I think there needs to be a lot of that, Tom. I really do. I mean, I'm not saying that was the decisive element. I am saying that that is the medium in which mm-hmm. all of politics is reflected, and that will be there every year from now on, and that's the ecology.
Well, we'll see. Mike in Natick, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, yes. Listen, Hillary has a right to speak this. In this book, I'm going to read it. Jack Beatty left out one thing. It was Comey, it was the Russians, and it was the press. During the campaigns, Trump got more free press than any other candidate by far. And Hillary should make that point. He was elected. It's ironic that he attacks the press immensely because he actually was elected because of the press. I watched speech after speech nonstop. Every channel covered this. Nonstop. Free of charge to Donald Trump. Hillary, with only blurbs he would get, was insulting the press, going after and picking it apart about emails. The press was the enemy of Hillary more than the Russians, and I would have to say it was a running tie with Comey because his timing was just took her knees right out of the at the worst possible time.
Mike, we've got it, and Hillary Clinton has certainly said that as well. So that's been was the most important thing here. Jennifer Jacobs, what about Hillary Clinton out in the public eye this week with her book out? She's saying a lot. People are listening. Does it make a difference in one way or another, either on current policy or understanding of the past or understanding of what may be coming in future presidential elections?
Right. That's exactly it. Do you remember Mitt Romney after his documentary Mitt came out after that 2012 election? People started having so many more, you know, warm feelings toward him, saying, we wish we'd seen that Mitt during the campaign. Mm-hmm. I'll be interested to see if people do change their opinions towards Hillary Clinton. One reason why the media covered Trump so much is because he was so very entertaining. It made TV viewers tune in. It got clicks on the internet. Yes, Hillary Clinton blames the press for some vapid coverage of her campaign. But I do know from our Bloomberg reporters that they tried to write more in-depth stories about her and you know, get her people on TV, you know, writing about policy and things like that. And her staff avoided that. But her book has some parts in it that are really candid and entertaining and very satisfying. She does admit, you know, when she said that damaging statement during that CNN town hall about putting coal miners out of business, how that came out garbled, and it was exactly the opposite of what she was, you know, meaning to say about her plan for jobs in coal country. And, you know, she says in her book, she wants to let her guard down. She wants people to start understanding her. So we'll see if things, you know, change. Does this help her public image?
But are entertaining candidates what we should be looking for now, Alan Gomez?
I don't know if we should be looking for them, but, you know, I think it's one thing to just sit there and say that this is all the media's fault and that we were throwing them out there and that's the only reason. But look, I can tell you throughout that campaign, I wrote I don't know how many policy stories about what Hillary's plan on immigration was, where Trump was on DACA, where all the candidates were on all these various immigration stories. Trump would make one quip about one of the other Republican candidates, and that story would get 10,000 more, you know, views from our readers than anything else. So at some point, it's, you know, we're, as Jennifer was just saying, a lot of us, all of us, we're trying to write policy stories and trying to write about these issues. You post them online, you tweet them, you do everything you can to get them in front of as many people as possible, but when the voters, when the people were the ones that were clicking like crazy and watching and searching and seeking out anything they could find on the latest crazy thing that Trump was saying on that campaign, it makes it hard. You know, at what point do we just grab people's head and say, read this, this is more important? It's at some point it comes back to them as well.
Steve Bannon out there talking in the last week as well with Charlie Rose on 60 Minutes. Lots of people watching that. Kind of rumpled and red eyes, red rimmed, and people talking about whatever that was pulsing at the side of his cheek there. But he very outspoken, and he said, "Well, of course, maybe Donald Trump shouldn't be so critical of Russia. We've got more important priorities." Here was Bannon on 60 Minutes.
We should be focused on how we bring the Cold War to an end, so we don't have to. And I think it was President Obama's program: $1 trillion. To upgrade the nuclear arsenal? Is that what you want to do? Is that where you want to spend your money? Would you rather spend $1 trillion in Cleveland, in Baltimore, in the inner cities of this country where we need to spend it, in the heartland of this nation? And I think what he's trying to say, in a world of anarchy, do you need another enemy?
Jack Beatty, are you persuaded? Lay off on the Russia criticism. We've got enough problems here at home.
That's the first time I've seen that argument made, that we be soft on Putin so we can have more infrastructure in America. You know, that nuclear modernization program he alluded to, President Trump is all with that. He's said several times, oh, we're in fact, he's represented that as his own program. And the idea that somehow if we didn't pay any, if we just basically gave Mr. Putin everything he wanted, which could include, I don't know, Estonia, Lithuania, who knows?
Countries.
Yeah. Suppose we said yes to whatever he wanted, would that put us in a better position in the world? I mean, you know, Steve Bannon is a, what is he known for? He made a movie of some kind, a documentary, and he ran a website. I mean, he has no authority.
He helped get a president of the United States elected, Jack, and that's no mean feat.
That's true, although the president is quick to say he came in very late in the day.
Yeah, well, he was ready to step up and defend Donald Trump on the Charlottesville comments there on 60 Minutes as well. Here was Steve Bannon Sunday night.
I was the only guy that came out and tried to defend him. I was the only guy that said he's talking about something, taking it up to a higher level. Where did this all go? Where does this end? Does it end in taking down the Washington Monument?
Jennifer Jacobs, does Steve Bannon matter anymore on the outside? He describes himself as a street fighter who would have Donald Trump's flank from outside the White House. But Breitbart went after Trump pretty hard this week on the DACA front.
Exactly. And a couple of weeks ago, Bannon was predicting civil war in the GOP if the DACA program were to be shifted back into Congress's hands, because there would be so much controversy between the establishment Republicans and the more conservative base Republicans. And he was exactly right. That's what we're seeing. We're seeing those Republicans, you know, fighting tooth and nail over this. Bannon's, you know, yes, he does matter. He's a passionate guy. He's very, very loyal to Trump. He's got a big voice in the media. Everyone will always listen to what he's saying. And what he's been saying is, you know, he's been trying to steer Trump back to that populist economic nationalist agenda that he thinks was what Trump was elected for. So he's a steering mechanism. He's always going to be out there trying to get Trump to go back to draining the swamp, to, you know, stop embracing the establishment, to turn back to some of those ideals that his people really wanted during the campaign. You know, I mean, the basic principles were they hate liberal ideology, they're sick of political correctness, they're fed up with corruptness in D.C., and then, you know, those key points, they want their border wall, they're tired of illegal immigrants.
Yeah. Jennifer, let me ask you, if I may, about the report this week that Donald Trump just tore into Jeff Sessions and called him an idiot in the Oval Office. New York Times reporting this, that Sessions submitted his resignation after that. It looked pretty well sourced. Are people buying this as an accurate reflection of what went on between these two, and why, Jennifer?
Yeah, it's possible. And we do know that the president does get very frustrated with people. And then it blows over. We know he was very frustrated with Gary Cohn after Gary Cohn did that interview with the Financial Times in which he spoke out, felt compelled to speak out against the president's reaction to the Charlottesville violence. And now we're told that he has, you know, moving on, that Gary Cohn is not in jeopardy of being fired or quitting or anything like that. They're getting along much better. So yes, that does seem like that's exactly what happened. The president has these big thunderstorms with his staff, and then it blows over.
Wow, an idiot. That's pretty wild. North Korea, we've seen the flight of this latest test missile again over Japan. Sirens going off in Japan, longer range than before. Is there anything new on the horizon, Jennifer, for addressing this?
I'm sorry, addressing what?
North Korea and its missile tests.
Right. Yes, I've been talking to national security officials about that for the last few hours and trying to see exactly what they're going to do. One national security official talked about how, you know, this is very serious. This particular missile went far enough that it could have reached Guam. It had that capability. So, again, they're going to be working. I know that Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, did talk to his counterparts in Japan and in South Korea. They're again,
again trying to figure out what happened. But keep in mind, they have a sketch. They have a plan. They have like a point by point. If this happens, then this is how our reaction. And they're sticking to that so far.
Does that mean that at some point, North Korea keeps going, we're at war?
I don't think that there are very many advisors around Trump right now that want to see a use of force. And even if President Trump would like a quick solution, maybe, you know, there are some who say that he really would like to just get this over with and you know, use a military solution just to end this. But his advisors have told me that they don't want that. They're steering Trump away from that. That would be an extreme last resort. And I'm just not getting the sense from anyone who's near to him that that's going to be anything that's going to be likely anytime soon.
Jennifer Jacobs, Equifax, in a word, is Washington going to step in here? 143 million people's personal data made vulnerable to all kinds of piracy out there. Republicans had been, you know, working with that industry to make it less accountable. Will that be turned around now?
Right. I asked Sarah Huckabee Sanders at a press briefing a couple days ago about that. Would the president consider this enough of an outrage that he would think that we need more regulation on financial companies and credit agencies such as this? And she surprised me when she said, yes, that is something we're going to look at. We would like Tom Bossert, the president's domestic advisor, to start looking into that. But it's possible that the market self-corrects this as well. You've got various consumer groups saying that we need a shift in the relationship between consumers and credit reporting companies, that people should be able to better keep track of their information and should better be able to, you know, freeze their files and have more control over whether this goes. So, yes, the administration is looking into more regulation, but it's possible that the market corrects itself as well.
Watch that space closely. A lot of people super frustrated this week over Equifax and its failings there. Ellen Gomez, Florida, on the comeback trail yet, or still licking its wounds?
Just starting, I would say. It's going to be a long few months down here, but yeah, we've been through this before. We'll get through it.
A lot of chainsaws, a lot of drying out to do, a lot to think about with these two enormous hurricanes hitting the U.S. in such a short span of time. Alan Gomez has been covering all of it for USA Today this week, and we're very grateful to you, Alan, for being with us from Miami today. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Jennifer Jacobs, White House reporter for Bloomberg News. Thank you very much, Jennifer.
Thanks, Tom.
Jack, thanks as always. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.